Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The schools may close, the pound may fall against the euro, but the slave lectures go on. Thank you for turning out in these blizzard conditions. Naturalism may have mapped conveniently onto many of the ideological coordinates of the Third Republic, and so benefited from state support, as my previous lecture suggested. But by the 1880s and 1890s, its cultural position, although dominant, was not unchallenged. It was a matter of style and ideology, the two inevitably intertwined. Naturalism had to compete with both the traditions and assumptions of the past, as well as with new initiatives and expectations generated, often enough, by the Republic's own forward momentum, or lack of it. France's cultural past offered manifold examples of different cultural styles. Collectively, these formed France's identity as Europe's cultural arbiter, a position the Third Republic strove to sustain via such systems as the Exposition Universelle. Separately, period styles carried with them associations of period politics, the sensuous arabesques of the Rococo echoing the Ancien Régime, or the severe authority of neoclassicism, the Napoleonic era. These were both styles and histories that could be read variously, the Ancien Régime as monarchy's political and economic failure, or as a flowering of intellectual enlightenment, the empire as glory and order, or despotism and disaster. But past styles continued to have present roles in our period. Indeed, they could be employed by the Republic. Pierre Puvis de Chavannes' Pro Patria Ludus, commissioned by the state for the museum at Amiens in 1880, exhibited at the Salon of 1887, and finally installed the following year, may be broadly classical in its balanced design and frieze-like groupings, but it nevertheless conveys apt civic values, family, continuity, community, national defence, and infiltrates the tricolour in the centre there as deftly as any mairie decoration. Past style could also appeal to the Republic's opponents. Giovanni Boldini's 1894 pastel of the reactionary comic writer Gyp matched soft virtuoso touch and a pearly tonality in a Rococo pastiche apt for the sitter, aristocratic, elitist, and anti-republican. Naturalism didn't just have to compete against other stylistic vocabularies with their multivalent cultural associations and claims on Frenchness. It also had to deal with the pressures of the present. The Republic's commitment to structural and social reform, its promotion of science and technology, all gave rise to new expectations, as well as to disappointments. Could visual culture adapt to the scientific mentalité, or to the burgeoning of the political left? Didn't naturalism's emphasis on the material, ally of secular republicanism, neglect the spiritual? In all these broad inheritances, assumptions and questions, style and ideology intertwine. One of the issues that haunted naturalism was whether it was a style at all. This was a consistent beef of more conservative critics. Reviewing the 1894 Salon des Artistes Français for Juliette Adon's nationalist Nouvelle Revue, Henri de Chelevière devoted a dozen pages to the religious and history paintings before skimming through the scenes of everyday life in a page and a half, asking if such realism was appropriate in the fine arts. But more sympathetic commentators had been weighing up the question for some time. André Michel, writing in 1885 for the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, the art review of record, argued that if the secret of emotion for a painting or a statue lies in the exactitude of its imitation and in its precision as a document, nothing would be more beautiful than a photograph or a cast from life. Real artists transform what they see, he went on. Modernity does not lie simply in contemporary subjects, and an artist like Gustave Moreau is modern because of his stylistic individuality. This was a warning that naturalism could appear style-less, lesser art than the evidently sui generis. In this passage, Michel twice used the word liberté to emphasise artists' freedom of choice, perhaps consciously and ironically adopting this political term. The Republic advocates liberty, yet impels artists towards an only quasi-consensual naturalism. At the Salon of 1887, Huysmans was faced with a number of medical subjects, including Dr. Charcot giving his course in front of Monsieur Naquet and Monsieur Clarity by André Bruyer on the right, and Péon working at the Hôpital Saint-Louis by Jovex. Huysmans complained that these canvases were impersonal in style. Either artist could have painted the other picture. But he also made a point of naming the leading figures. I suggest that this identification went beyond expected accuracy. Charcot, the doctor in the image on the right, owed his chair in maladies of the nervous system to Gambetta's parliamentary support. The anti-clerical deputy Naquet had been the prime mover of the new divorce legislation in 1884. Clarity directed the state Comédie Française and wrote for the moderate Republican Le Temps. Péon was a pioneering abdominal surgeon elected to the Académie de Médecine in 1887. Huysmans was listing Republican stalwarts, and when he called such a painting orthodox, well-behaved, he was implying more than stylelessness. The young intellectuals reading his critique in the Revue Indépendante would have picked up the orthodox equation. Republican staffage, Republican style, ergo naturalism. From the later 1880s, this kind of painting increasingly came under attack from the generation in their 20s, critical of the Republic and thus its dominant aesthetic, sympathetic to innovative currents such as symbolism. Félix Fénéon's review of the 1889 Salon, again from the Revue Indépendante, can stand for this position, damning painters such as Émile Friant and Pascal Daniel Bouveret as statisticians and cataloguers, anxious to leave to the future documents on a plenipotentiary minister, an actor, or a heating workshop, or one might add here, the unemployed and the churchgoers, all of which Fénéon said look the same and seem effectively photographic. But how well do these criticisms stand up? Certainly the condemnation of naturalist painting as photographic was a commonplace. As early as 1883, the reactionary Catholic critic Josephin Peladon had pronounced that of the 2,488 paintings at the Salon, 2,300 would have been better realised using colour photography. By the first years of the 1890s, symbolist critics such as Alphonse Germain puffed their preferred artists, in Germain's case Alexandre Seyon, by praising their distinctly unphotographic styles. And even a civil servant like Georges Lafenestre, a Louvre curator, was complaining that photographic exactitude made for desiccated painting. Accusations that paintings were photographic were bandied about to criticise any kind of descriptive painting, inappositely by Huysmans in the case of Rolle's huge Le Travail, the figures in which had in fact been crafted from many drawings from life, and the picture was broadly and robustly painted. Paintings could also be defended from the photographic slur. In 1887, Georges Ollendorff reckoned that Édouard Danton's The Cast from Life had been saved from being a motif from pornographic photography by the quality of its painterly tonalities, while 2 years later Paul Mantz, admiring the almost scientific accuracy of Friant's All Saints Day, found the way the painter had evoked a sense of movement excellent at a time when instantaneous photography was beginning to clarify the mysteries of locomotion. Friant, in fact, had gone out of his way in this large canvas to prove his painterliness. The road and the wall, for instance, are visibly and scrubbily brushed, and critics and cartoonists' determination to deal with this picture one way or the other in photographic terms only goes to show the persistence of this up-to-the-minute cliché. On occasion, a picture could even be praised for surpassing a photograph. Mixing his journalistic metaphors promiscuously, Louis Hennaut thought that Jean Béraud's 1890 casino scene of, I quote, the Moorish room where the roulette fairy holds her grand assizes, at the moment when the croupier pronounces the sacramental rien ne va plus, was so superior to the most instantaneous of cameras in its ability to catch the gambler's fever. The idea of the photographic coloured contemporary criticism. This was less because paintings actually looked like photographs. Most artists were keen to show their graphic and painterly skills and not to be merely mimetic, but rather because the photograph was a useful metaphor. Apparently as legible as a naturalist painting, the photographic analogy was similarly polyvalent. It could summarise a painting's vices, imitative, unimaginative, styleless, or its virtues, precise, spontaneous, modern. It is important to remember that at this period, photography itself was in a state of constant technological development. The colour photography about which Peladon had ironised was still only at an experimental stage, but photography was making greater inroads into public experience and practice. It was gradually being used in books and periodicals. Georges Rodenbach's novel Bruges la Mort, published in 1892, was one of the very first novels to be illustrated with photographs. But that innovatory character was mitigated by Rodenbach's deliberately anti-modern attitudes. First, in selecting photographs only of medieval Bruges to suit the text, and second, in preferring old-fashioned collodion photographs. Edgar Degas, who took up photography with enthusiasm in the 1890s, used outdated equipment, which required his sitters to endure painfully slow exposure times. This is Mallarmé and Renoir, and I show it small because these photographs are very small. This goes some way to explaining both the self-supporting poses his sitters frequently adopted and also the somewhat meditative character of his subtly lit interiors. A generation younger, Édouard Vuillard bought himself a new Kodak in the late 1890s. With its fast shutter speed, the Kodak made snapshots, instantanés, hitherto possible only for the expert, available to the amateur public. The technological advance, however, was offset by disadvantages. The Kodak had no viewer and could only be pointed, hopefully, in the direction of the subject, and its fixed focus might catch the central motif, but the periphery would likely be blurred. Vuillard appreciated the Kodak's accidental results, using it enthusiastically as an aide-mémoire, but he only rarely used his photographs as foundations for a painting. The same seems to have been true for Degas. For Vuillard and Degas, photography was a stimulating new medium allied to looking, fixing things seen, prompting possibilities for poses and groupings, but never challenging the business of making, that truculent crafting of an image from intractable materials by the alliance of eye and hand. Style came first. Innovations in photography interplayed with naturalist art throughout the 1880s and 90s, but in ways that linked painting to wider patterns. During the 1880s, the instantanés allowed amateurs their fun, but it also had specific engagement with picture making. The celebrated painter Ernest Meissonier expected that the sequential photographs of equine movements taken in California by Edward Muybridge would prove the validity of his own pictorial solutions. When Muybridge visited Paris in 1881, Meissonier acted as translator when the photographer's work was presented at the Cercle de l'Union Artistique that December. But whereas the photographs in Attitudes of Animals in Motion sustained Meissonier's previous treatment of the horse's walk, they showed him at fault with trot, canter and gallop. Subsequent paintings, such as General Championnet on the seashore, show how the humbled Meissonier anxiously retouched the animal's gait. Apparently his own copy of Meissonier's photographic album is hardly touched, as if Meissonier flinched from the scientific evidence that had not certified the accuracy by which he set so much store. This kind of interdisciplinary exchange was not uncommon at the period. In his 1889 book, Les Jeux du Cirque et de la Vie Foraine, itself a documentary account of the circus world, Hugues Leroux described how in June of the previous year, a clown and a gymnast had performed privately at the Hippodrome in front of 50 photographers organised by the president of the Société d'Excursion Française de Photographie. Each cameraman took a dozen plates, 600 in all, a mere 10 of which were judged worth printing as precise records of the acrobats in, as Leroux put it, those intermediary poses which the eye can never seize and the quickest instantaneous photography has not fixed until now. 9 of those 10 photographs were then drawn by Jules Garnier to illustrate Leroux's book, the image's photographic provenance matching the accuracy of the text's detailed account. Those 10 photographs had been selected by Albert Londe, director of the photographic section at the Salpêtrière Mental Hospital, whose day job was recording the phases of hysterical fits and other conditions as a scientific archive for the researches of Charcot and his psychologist colleagues. If the collaborations between Meissonier and Muybridge, or Leroux, Londe and Garnier, were semi-public, the accurate fruit of the instantané can also be picked on the sly. Working with Alfred Steffens, Javex led a team of artists who painted the Panorama du Siècle, long strips of which I showed in my first lecture, and this is a more life-size section now in the Musée Carnavalet. It was a vast survey of major figures in French history and culture since the French Revolution and formed one of the attractions of the 1889 Exposition Universelle. Prestigious visitors were welcomed to the studio where this huge enterprise was underway, and Javex took these opportunities surreptitiously to photograph individuals, seizing a spontaneous pose for inclusion in the panorama. The section of the panorama including President Carnot has some figures who appear dropped into the group, suggesting that the composition was a bricolage of portraits painted from life and from photographs. If this was the creative use of the new technology for the benefit of painting, it seems that painters might also appropriate the forms of photography. The Paris Prefecture of Police had not been slow to introduce scientific aids of various kinds, and by 1882 had some 66,000 photographs of criminals in their archives to help identify recidivists. This system was becoming more sophisticated under the aegis of Alphonse Bertillon, the head of the statistical section. Bertillon introduced profile photographs to supplement frontal ones, wittily submitting himself to the process, and developed anthropometry, the measurement of the head and its features to supplement photography as an aid to identification. Edmond Amangean's portrait of 1892 of the poet Paul Verlaine seems to echo the formalised frontality of criminal photography. The portrait's institutionalised character was entirely appropriate, given that the painting was made, if not at a police station, then at the hospital Bruces, where Professor Chauffard treated Verlaine's syphilis and Amangean represented him gruff and constrained. It is wrong to suggest, as some recent historians have, that photorealism was a clandestine strategy employed by certain artists as a means of generating a sophisticated form of naturalist painting. During the 1880s and 90s, many artists had recourse to photographs, among them painters such as Gustave Moreau and Maurice Denis, whose work was emphatically unnaturalistic. Photography simply provided the artist with another tool towards the creation of a work, adding to more time-honoured means such as the life drawing, oil sketch, lay figure or plaster model. On occasion, using a photograph was unavoidable, as when Joseph Reinach commissioned a commemorative portrait of Gambetta from Bonnard in 1888 5 years after the politician's death. At the Salon of 1885, Gérôme exhibited the baths at Bursa, which critics like Ollendorf described as photographic. Having no access to a harem, Gérôme would have been obliged to concoct his composition, using photographs of the architecture, to which he added the figures, which, for Ollendorf, were very exactly painted, but their nudity is not respectable. Even though photography was used as a necessary expedient, it nevertheless served to validate the ethnographic validity of such a painting. Gérôme's former pupils certainly used photographs. Jules Alexis Meunier, who lived in his master's old house near Vesoul, had his own photographic studio there. Details, like the plants in the 1890 painting Catechism lesson, were taken from glass plate photographic negatives, which survive. Like Degas and Rodenbach, Meunier was not necessarily cutting edge with his appareil photographique. But, as with so many of these paintings, the Catechism lesson was probably based on a combination of methods. Preliminary drawings, photographs, direct painting. The combination of which was intended to achieve the illusion of actuality. Another Gérôme pupil who used photography extensively was Daniel Bouveret. The Bretons at a Pardon, which he exhibited at the 1887 Salon, used photographs taken at Roumongol, Brittany, in 1886, and at Aumois, his home in eastern France, the following year. The artifice of his naturalism, if not his use of photography, did not escape Octave Mirbeau, who ironized in the Echo de Paris, "Monsieur Daniel Bouveret brings us back a hand-picked selection of Bretons direct from the Jura." The crucial point here is that naturalism was never natural. However exact or photographic or styleless it appeared to be, naturalist painting was always the result of the craft and contrivances of studio practice. One of the painters whose work most consciously, I believe, acknowledged artifice in his painting was Danton. His Restoration, shown at the 1891 Salon des Artistes Français and now lost, shows a craftsman sculptor repairing the neoclassical Winter by Jean-Baptiste Debay as the model descends from the dais on which she's been posing. The scene is scrupulously observed in both material and moral terms, with the inventories of casts and tools in the background, the specific and momentary movements of concentrated carving and careful steps, as well as the absolute indifference to each other of the working man and naked woman. Danton used photography in his studio practice and may have done so with this painting. But Restoration is too knowingly a meditation on the artifices of crafting the ideal from the real to be summarized as merely photographic. Photography was only a tool for naturalism, an aid to boost the expected exactitude, not a defining technique. But photography did intersect with different worlds. I've already touched on medicine, the police, zoology, and the circus, because it was of practical aid in many fields, but also because it was new, scientific, and modern. No wonder photographic parallels of one kind or another were so often drawn with painting. They were a shorthand for dealing with material, things, and the exact, and above all, with the modern. But for painters, photography was a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it served artists as a useful tool. It aided the achievement of accuracy that satisfied the contemporary demand for the document. But on the other, the public's expectation of pictorial actuality and its easy assumption that photography offered visual truth increasingly put pressure on painters. Should they continue to paint descriptively, suiting the documentary mentalité of the cultural consensus? Could they enlarge the scope of the naturalist aesthetic, ensuring that their manipulation of touch and surface gave their work a creative individuality which would absolve it from jibes about being mechanistic and styleless? Or was the increasing sophistication of photography as a medium and its ubiquity in the public mind combined with naturalism's collusion with consensual bourgeois republicanism, enough to drive the independent painter towards style. In his review of the Salon of 1884 for the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, Louis de Forcault, an experienced critic, friend of artists, and by no means implacably opposed to naturalism, which he recognised as part of the French tradition, launched an attack on what he saw as willful eccentricities of composition in recent painting. Forcault resented the modernisme, which had proliferated off-centre, broken, divided, paradoxical compositions, offering to the eye, for no valid reason, people or animals cropped by a golden frame. He identified one particular originator of these compositional devices, who he acknowledged as an artist of high rank, observer of a marvellous acuity, draftsman of the first order, Edgar Degas. Degas was not showing at the Salon, had not done so since 1870, but at the independent Impressionist exhibitions of the mid and later 70s, he had been exhibiting pictures which Forcault described as pioneering these compositional eccentricities. Forcault specified in his article ballet subjects representing only the bottom of the stage and the top of the orchestra, and a racecourse picture with a horse as if sliced by a post. The problem, in his view, was not Degas' remarkably innovatory composition, but the fact that they had already become a convention, a mania with other artists. The critic was particularly incensed by an equestrian portrait of a gentleman, of a general, by a now forgotten artist at the 1884 Salon, which represented him in procession with half lancers and half horses. Forcault was correct, of course, about the outstanding calibre and invention of Degas' work, but he was misguided on two counts. First, for all Degas' extraordinary innovation, he was not single-handedly responsible for the compositional devices Forcault itemised. On the one hand, Degas had developed such possibilities from the study of earlier art, whether old master painting or Japanese woodcuts. On the other, pictorial artifices such as off-centre focus of interest, cut-off figures, and spatial voids had been pioneered in parallel, if not even in collaboration, with colleagues such as Giuseppe De Nittis, as paintings such as Riders in the Champs-Élysées of 1875 demonstrate. Forcault's second slip is linked, for he neglected to ask why such compositional conventions were explored and then widely adopted. We should look for answers, I suggest, beyond the mere business of description, and in a growing consciousness about perception. A painting like Degas' ballet of Robert le Diable, probably exhibited at the 1876 Impressionist exhibition, is alert to processes of looking. If our gaze is on our immediate surroundings, the gentlemen around us in the front stalls, then what is on stage is only in our peripheral vision, which Degas correspondingly evokes by a more approximate brushwork. De Nittis' Riders on the Champs-Élysées prompts notions about how the act of looking is one of constant readjustment. A moment ago, the riders were in bright sunshine. Our eyes see them differently now they have moved into shadow. The birds pecking at the horse droppings will in a moment fly away as the dogs and horses approach. By depicting an instant present, such a picture suggests an immediate past and future, and the continuum of perception. Across French and particularly Parisian culture, there was an increasing understanding that the pace of life was speeding up. Because urban life gave rise to the accidental, because visual experience could seem partial or spatial perception disconcerting, forms of representation needed to adapt to the new momentum and perceptual disequilibrium that went with it. If conditions of modernity were unstable and ambiguous, then the conventions of representations needed to be adapted to accommodate them. The modernisme that Foucault found formulaic was in fact an aspect of the naturalist aesthetic's adaptation of its representational languages to the newly prevailing conditions of life. This adaptation was not merely concerned with modern subject, but also with how to represent it in a modern way, thus with style. And it was interdisciplinary, working across the cultural forms. Reviewing the performance of Edmond de Goncourt's play Sœur Philomène at André Antoine's Théâtre Libre in October 1887, the influential theatre critic Francisque Sarcy fulminated against the actors showing the back, performing and delivering lines while facing away from the audience. His objection was similar to Foucault's, the breaking of stylistic convention in favour of the artifices of actuality. Interestingly enough, Antoine's theatrical innovations were recycled in relation to the visual arts. For in 1893, Jean Robiquet responded to Rolle's centenary of the Estates General by reminding his readers in L'Art et l'Idée that the figures seen from behind were doubtless as Monsieur Antoine would have directed. Equivalent responses to the fragmentation of experience found in painting can be read in the naturalist novel. Alphonse Daudet's Froment Jeune et Risler Aîné, for example, includes a section during a banquet. The guests were turning towards one another. The sleeve of a dress suit was visible behind a vase of Asclepius, a child's smiling face above an ice cream, which parallels the choppy visual disjunction in Degas' pictures and coincides in date, 1874, with the start of such pictorial experiments. This sort of fragmentary description became as commonplace in naturalist literature as painting. One finds it again in 1885 in a crowd scene in Maupassant's Bel Ami. Jostled, bumped and squashed, swept this way and that, they walked on, seeing nothing but a population of hats. The girls in pairs were threading their way expertly through the press of men, slipping between elbows and chests and backs. Artist, novelist and theatre director were all interested in innovative equations of stylistic devices which didn't just deal with the everyday world as subject, but which adapted their medium's language to the pace and disjunction of one's everyday perception. That artists at this period were very conscious of the processes of looking is found not only in the evidence of their pictures, but also in their statements. Bastien Lepage told his friend Thurier that contemplating a landscape when seated set things against the sky with ample surrounding space. But from a standing position, one sees objects against others further away. As Bastien Lepage himself said, they mingle confusedly with the background, which instead of receding, seems to come forward, an effect that he had tried to realise in Père Jacques of 1882. Bastien went on, we need to revisit the education of our eye, looking sincerely at how things are in nature, instead of taking for absolute truths the theories or conventions of art school. Bastien's understanding of the differences of looking from different angles was applied in another canvas of 1882, Pas Mèche, or Nothing Doing. The village urchin is aged about 10, and the spectator's viewpoint is that of an adult looking slightly down on his cheeky presence. Viewpoint was crucial to pictures which wanted to suggest a sense of likelihood as much by their evocation of perceptual, even physical states, as by the accuracy of their depiction. Thus, Francis Tattegrain's Return from Fishing at Berck-sur-Mer of 1878 makes the spectator look upwards at the vessel plying towards us, as if our boat were in the trough between two waves, a disconcerting but entirely plausible viewpoint. One of Jean Barrault's paintings from the Salon of 1882 had as its title not the location of his cityscape, which is exact enough, the top of the Arc de Triomphe, looking eastwards. Instead, the title accords with the swaying woman's sensations up there and our own plunging view down onto the Champs-Élysées. Vertigo. This physical reaction is enhanced by the way Barrault tilted the surface on which the spectator implicitly stands and used the sharply rising perspective of the avenue below to heighten the sense of void on the other side of the parapet. Both Tattegat and Barrault employed compositional devices, notably angle of vision and perspective, the better to conjure up in the spectator the physical sensation and perceptual plausibility. Style working with subject to sharpen the naturalistic actuality. Critics were aware that this is what artists intended and relayed this to their readers, as Georges Lafenestre did in 1892 when he pointed out vis-à-vis a Napoleonic battle picture by Dutheil that we, the spectator, are standing amongst the Austrian staff officers. All these compositional gambits are to be found in Degas's work from the mid-1870s onwards. The precise implication of the spectator's placement occurs in the sharp angle downward of, in L'Étoile from the 1877 Impressionist exhibition, as if we're looking from a box, while the awareness of looking up at something from below is salient in Miss Lala at the Circus Fernando, shown in 1879. Degas' compositional inventiveness was prodigious, his understanding of the nature of looking acute. But in 1884, Foucault overestimated his individual impact. Indeed, there was no substantial display of Degas' work in Paris between 1881 and 1886, and artists like Tattegat, who moved in quite different circles, were arriving independently at similar solutions. Degas' work, when it could be seen, set standards. But his importance, even for younger artists who knew him, was equivocal. Georges Janniot remembered that on his second visit to Degas' studio in 1881, he had seen a racecourse picture on the easel, not necessarily that one, but one similar to it. The asymmetrical distribution of the figures and the use of angled spatial voids that one finds in Degas' racing subjects of the early 80s may well have informed the composition of Janniot's The Line of Fire, exhibited at the 1886 Salon. But Janniot's painting operates on quite different levels. At 2 by 3 metres, so the size that you see there, it is much larger than Degas' racecourses, and Janniot deliberately used the size, as he did the detail of stubbled field, incoming bullets, wounded men, and obscuring gun smoke for particular purposes. That was to create a pictorial evocation of an engagement during the Battle of Raisonville on the 16th of August 1870, at which Janniot had fought as a sub-lieutenant in the 23rd Infantry. The painting was at one level personally cathartic. At another, a life-size, head-on recreation for the genteel salon public of the physical and psychological realities of combat, noise, pain, fear, confusion. Critics such as Maupassant and Alfred de Lostolo responded to Janniot's Line of Fire, both in terms of its veristic depiction of violence and in terms of style, the unusual chromatics of the harsh summer light attracting attention. My point here is that in the best naturalist painting, style was carefully contrived by decisions about composition, colour and touch, and that its elision with description gave the picture value beyond merely accurate accounting. What is important to my argument is the sustainability and vitality of naturalism in the 1890s. By this I mean more than the tedious repetitiveness of descriptive paintings at public exhibitions, a turgid current that carried on well into the 20th century and which, in its dreary continuity, has much to say about the lure of the mimetic. The very volume of that kind of art, in France and many other countries, confirms that appetite. More specifically, I would like to argue that during the 1890s, naturalism, and here I remind you of my broad understanding of the term, remained a dominating, dynamic, even still innovatory current in French visual culture. This is not an argument that all my listeners will immediately accept, I suspect, because the modernist bias of our culture, and of much art history, draws us to peaks of individuality and innovation, focuses on figures such as Mallarmé and Cézanne, and assumes by the 1890s the primacy of symbolism or post-impressionism. But these were individual, isolated voices, their contemporary resonance reaching only small elites. My argument is concerned less with aesthetic quality or durability, as with the more tangible practicalities of that decade's pictorial production and understanding. From this point of view, naturalism flourished, because its stylistic flexibility gave artists scope, and its legibility continued to address public expectations. By the 90s, the pictorial devices which had seemed innovatory in the early 1880s had become commonplace, but they survived as a valid gambit in the artistic repertoire because they still carried with them assumptions about modernity. In canvases of the 1890s, Renoir, after a decade of stylistic diversity and dead ends, returned to the reassurance of naturalism. Paintings such as Christine Lerolle embroidering or Breakfast at Berneval, painted in the later 1890s, represent the foreground figures only partially and divert our attention by activity in a further space. Even at that date, such paintings could seem challenging, for when Christine Lerolle was posing for one of Renoir's pictures, her grandfather, probably in her 70s, muttered, "Ugh, that's the new painting." Even the young Henri Matisse, in one of his earliest figure compositions, The Breton Maid of 1896, had recourse to the cut-off figure and the open door, which work both in pictorial terms, contrasting volume and void, introducing cool tones against the warm, and naturalistically, catching the momentary movement, implying action off. My final lecture will explore the unrecognised return to naturalism among some of the avant-garde in the late 1890s. But I want to close this one by giving some sense of the ways in which naturalist painting developed during that decade. Reviewing the two salons of 1891 for the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, the Swiss novelist Edouard Rod first suggested that realistic painting has disappeared. It's hiding in the town halls, decorating the walls with electoral scenes. Or rather, having lost its gross and violent qualities, it's become jolly, kind and good-natured, and gives us the lovely cream and fromage blanc cellar by Monsieur Dombourguez. A wonderful painting which I've not been able to trace. But Rod then moderated his position, admiring the ingenious realism of Gervex, Janniot and others. Naturalism had no more departed in painting than it had in literature. 1891 was also the year when the journalist Jules Huret ran a series of interviews in L'Echo de Paris with poets and novelists, asking whether naturalism was finished and whether it had been supplanted by symbolism. Published as a book, Enquête sur l'évolution littéraire, the title manifested the Darwinian notion of evolutionary struggle that underpinned Huret's questions. I would argue that in the 1890s, naturalist painting evolved. Shifts in the political and social environment shaped those gradual changes. In the 1880s, many major salon paintings had concentrated on images of often lower class collectivity. We found this in Lhermitte's Harvesters, Friant's Oarsmen, Daniel's Pardon and Rolle's work. Such paintings addressed the nouvelle couche sociale, publicly validating their role in the Republic in images of égalité and fraternité. Paintings like these assumed as fundamentally unproblematic the subjects they took and the civic values that they implied: labour, duty, family, community. By the 1890s, that sense of a relatively consistent politico-social momentum sharing in which many artists... sorry, I beg your pardon. I've written on my text and I can't read it. Anyway, that sense of a relatively consistent politico-social momentum propelled by government support had stuttered and even begun to fragment. While the Republic held the centre ground strongly enough, the dangerously populist Boulanger affair of the late 1880s had shown the Republic's the appeal to important fringes, nationalists and the petit bourgeoisie, was friable. The financial chicanery of the Panama scandal of the early 1890s has exposed the Republican political elite, and the increasing success of the socialists in the polls demonstrated that growing sections of the proletariat were dissatisfied with the pace of industrial reform. It was within this shifting politico-social environment that naturalist painting evolved. In the 1890s, it had to deal with a greater sense of social disjunction. Artists such as Jules Adler, whose work we will see in a moment, emerged with opinions to the left of republicanism and an imagery of strikes and unemployment to match. Rod's 1891 assessment was not entirely wrong. There was a current in naturalism that was gentle and engaging, the kind of art that pleased the public, that seemed true enough and avoided the harsher aspects of contemporary existence, and even perhaps acknowledged the elusive, emotive ambience of symbolism. One thinks here of pictures such as Daniel's Elegiac in the Forest of 1892, or the elderly Jules Breton's sequence of nostalgic sundown landscapes of his native Artois. These were only some of the ways in which naturalism evolved in the 1890s. If one of the trends in the later 1870s and 1880s naturalism had been the development of devices intended to evoke in the eye of the viewer a sense of spontaneous actuality, this was answered in the 90s by an inclination towards slightly more stylized, even ritualistic kinds of composition. As we've seen, Friant's 1888 All Saints' Day depicted the customary annual visit to the cemetery. The immediate happenstance of the unfolding appearance of the bourgeois family into our field of vision and the girls preparing to give the blind beggar a coin is subtly formalised by their loosely processional progress across the snow-covered pavement. A decade later, Henri Royer's In Flanders Evening again used life-size figures, requiring the viewer to read them one-to-one. Royer used several of the actualising devices we've observed. Figures in mid-step, seen from behind, off-centre placement, half-hidden features. But the painting's dimming light, black capes and processional pairing were creative decisions apt for representing life among the workers' terraces in the still strongly Catholic departments of northern France. Jules Adler's In the Land of the Mine of 1901 represents Flemish miners leaving their shift. While Adler made painterly choices, which were consistent with the grimness of the scene, a dark brown tonality with slag heap, chimneys and lifting gear silhouetted against the livid failing light, they were matched with an almost ironic decision to represent the miners bent backed from their work below ground, moving in silent procession across the canvas. Adler's title, Au pays de la mine, may well have deliberately echoed the prefix Au pays de la mer, which Charles Cotte used generically from 1895 for his scenes of rugged Finistère. At the 1897 Salon de la Nationale, Cotte exhibited under this rubric Stormy Evening, People Passing, of which I'm afraid I can only show you the print and not the painting. Here, Breton men and women to and fro along a quayside at Camaret. Once more, the artist is descriptive. The coifs are no doubt specific to place and uses naturalism's ploys of actuality. Staffage close to, no specific focus, cut-off figures. And yet again, one is conscious of the crafting of style. High horizon and limited sky cramp the space for the sombre-coloured, roughly brushed, heavily silhouetted figures. How the painting was made adds empathetically to its subject, anxious waiting for fishing boats to come in from the storm. These two paintings of workers by Adler and Cotte show substantial numbers of people, but they are neither quite crowds nor collectives. The pictures cluster generally separate figures, caught up in their own thoughts and purposes. They are images less of individuality, although fatigue or anxiety may be read on their faces, than of alienation, the oppression of labour, the absence of escape. By their search for style, not just the individual imprint of the artist, but a knowing play with representational conventions, such paintings once again demonstrate the flexibility of naturalism. It was able to evolve as a visual language, to add style to description while staying true to observation. Early in his career, Cotte's work had hovered between the slightly caricatural and the very descriptive. The Coast of Toulangé, a pastel of 1891, shows Cotte at his most scrupulously precise, tracing every tide mark and crack in the granite, as if to satisfy a geologist, in this image of one of the furthest fingers of Finistère reaching out into the Atlantic. Cotte had discovered the fishing port of Camaret at the end of the Crozon Peninsula in 1886. Savoyard and bourgeois son of a judge, he was an outsider there, but committed himself to the representation of this pays, returning annually and staying throughout the cholera epidemic of 1894, the only foreigner to do so. Closely as Cotte got to know Camaret folkways, he abandoned a highly descriptive technique, used by others for quasi-ethnographic painting, and evolved a rougher manner, which drew comparison with Rembrandt, Chardin, and particularly Courbet. Paintings such as Jean d'Ouessant veillant an enfant mort, or people from Ouessant staying up with a dead baby, from the 1899 Salon de la Nationale, typify the way in which Cotte took scenes from the harsh Breton life that he had experienced at first hand and made from them intense works of art. Powerfully impasted strokes, sombre tonalities illuminated by sharp accents of colour, ritualised profiles, all characterised Cotte's Au Pays de la Mer canvases, including the great triptych of 1898, Les Adieux, The Farewells. Critics were unsure how to define these powerful paintings. Writing in 1898, Benedict argued that Cotte and his close friend Lucien Simon were reacting against naturalism and looking back to the old masters. This was not a new way of assessing Cotte, and when one looks at Simon's major painting of the period, Procession at Pamar of 1900, with its confident painterly handling of rubicund faces and strongly lit drapery, one recognises the lessons Simon had drawn from Hals, Rubens and Velázquez on trips to the Low Countries in Spain earlier in his career. But Benedict's position on Cotte, Simon and naturalism was somewhat elastic. As a Republican fonctionnaire, it was instinctive for him to find in their work ideals of fraternity and justice, and to see them as characterising the epoch. The painter Laetitia Hazard du Marest, writing in 1901, argued that Cotte's depiction of Finistère people had gone beyond the quasi-scientific, what she called the heredity of physiognomic evidence, to achieve a higher kind of naturalism. Works of suggestive natural truth, among the most integral definitions of humanity. By 1904, Benedict had arrived at the same position. Cotte had surpassed ethnographic description to achieve a mythic humanitarianism. Some of you may find it difficult today to agree with these claims that Cotte was a major artist. But around 1900, he certainly appeared so. The triptych Les Adieux won a gold medal at the 1900 Exposition Universelle, having been purchased by the state 2 years before. The paintings of Cotte and of Simon, Adler and others stretched the bounds of naturalism, pulling away from the descriptive and dangerously styleless to work in which style counted, in which to adapt Zola's dictum, temperament began to get the upper hand over nature. Cotet's cultivated crudeness or Seymour's confident surfaces made for more individualistic phrasings of the naturalist aesthetic than older artists such as a Lhermitte or a Daniel, let alone the official art of Détaille. The generation which matured in the 1890s no longer had to make such a sharp break from the convention of art school training or make such obviously common cause with Republican rhetoric. For by the 90s, these currents had coalesced. The expectations of how art should be made and what it should address, uniting in the naturalist aesthetic which dominated because, in its diversity, it so suited political ideology, educational desiderata, public taste, and the articulation of national identity. Above all, naturalism's flexibility, its ability to evolve, deepened its roots in the national mentalité because it could reach out to the multiple constituencies that made up France. Thank you.